Hello and welcome. My name is Nick Davies and I'm a Programme Director here at the Institute for Government. On behalf of the Institute and ACAS, thank you very much for joining us for this discussion on how public sector strikes can be resolved more effectively. Public services have faced the greatest level of disruption from strikes in more than a quarter of a century. Over the past year, nurses, ambulance drivers, teachers, junior doctors, consultants, and civil servants, amongst others, have all staged walkouts to protest against pay and working conditions. While improved pay offers from Rishi Sunak's government have resolved many disputes and others have fizzled out, some disputes could flare up again and others are still on the picket line. Indeed, just yesterday, it was announced that junior doctors will continue to strike, with 98% voting in favour of continuing that action. So what impact have recent industrial disputes had on public service performance? What skills do ministers, civil servants, frontline public service leaders and unions need to effectively negotiate and resolve disputes? What mechanisms can be used to resolve entrenched disputes? How effective are pay review bodies and do they need to be reformed? And to what extent will the Strikes Minimum Service Levels Act help or hinder the management of industrial disputes? To discuss those issues and more, I'm delighted to be joined by Baroness Simone Finn, former government advisor on industrial relations, Mike Clancy, General Secretary at Prospect, Raj Jethwa, Chief Executive of the Universities and College Employers Association, and Kate Nowitzki, Director of Dispute Resolution at ACAS. Each of our panellists will make opening remarks, and I'll ask some follow-up questions before opening up to questions from the audience. If you have any questions for our panellists and you're in the room, please do raise your hand. If you are watching remotely, then you can start submitting your questions now using the Slido online Q&A function. And I will try to ask as many of those questions as possible. We'll also be tweeting from the @IFGEvents Twitter account, and I recommend you tweet along as well if you like, using #IFGPublicServices. Right, without further ado, I'm going to come to our first speaker, Baroness Simone Finn.
Thank you very much. So as you've just been told, I was the industrial relations advisor at the beginning of the coalition, so in 2010. So my experience is sort of fairly historic. But there were some key points that I would like to sort of draw from that time, because we were facing, a massive, then as now, we were facing a massive budget deficit, and we had to, one of the main aims, I was working as an advisor at the time for Francis Mort, who was the minister in the Cabinet Office, and one of the first things he wanted to do was, he wanted to do the bonfire of the quangos and look at how to cut the numbers down, and also how to cut the size of the civil service. And for that, one needed a proper compensation scheme, in that it was too expensive actually to get rid of people at that stage. So there needed to be a scheme that would actually allow voluntary redundancy as an option, and would be on more favourable terms than the compulsory redundancy that was in the offing. And this wasn't. This had been something that I think Tessa Jowell, who was then France's opposition number, had started to do in her tenure just before the election. So we took up the mantle there and then moved on in 2011 to the public sector pensions reform, which did sort of, which did have finally at the end of that year a sort of a heads of agreement and a satisfactory outcome with the unions. And just as things that I recall from that time, first of all, trade union, the relationships with the trade union leaders were actually very strong. I mean, I'm sure Brendan Barber and Dave Prentice will not thank me for saying that they engaged incredibly constructively. But the personal relationships were strong between Danny Alexander, who's then Chief Secretary, and Francis, and particularly Brendan and Dave Prentice. And And it was really important to build up those personal relationships, to have some element of trust that and to be straightforward about what we were trying to achieve, and that they would negotiate in good faith to achieve important concessions, which they did achieve, and the other sort of union leaders, particularly the civil service leaders at the time. I think it was Jonathan Baum, and we've dealt with Die Hard in Prospect. But it was interesting that PCS never wanted to come to the table and negotiate in good faith, and it was actually the unions who really wanted to achieve things for their members who got it. And the other thing we were told all the time, and I really came to realise, is that just no surprises. You know, don't announce something. The Treasury's approach to negotiation was to say, oh, but we're going to do this, we'll announce these plans, and then we'll tell them they're happening, and that's going to be a negotiation. And in fairness to Danny Alexander, he understood that you had to phrase things as proposals, not plans, that you actually did have to come to the table. And David Cameron took the whole industrial relations landscape fairly seriously, in that there was the first mince pie summit at the end of 2010, where the TUC and other unions and union leaders all came into Number 10, and David Cameron, as Prime Minister, committed to having negotiations on the pension reform. And, you know, at the end of it, achieved quite important concessions, you know, that the lower paid people were looked after, that those closer to retirement were looked after. And it wasn't always about pay. It was sometimes there were other factors that came in that were part of the negotiation. And the other thing that worked very well in those days was the fact that there were proper structures, which we inherited presumably from the Labour Party, to deal with the trade unions, but things like the Public Service Forum in the Cabinet Office, so that everyone could get round the table and talk. Ministers have to be properly engaged with those bodies, but they were incredibly helpful to listen to what the real concerns were. Likewise, in the Department of Health, I don't think it's being used properly at the moment, but Patricia Hewitt had put in place the social partnership, and where union leaders and the NHS and ministers and officials would actually come and talk about what the problems were. And there's a bit that I feel the dialogue has broken down somewhat. The issues just seems to be focusing on pay, and that there are quite a lot of other factors that where there could be common ground and consensus reached.
Thank you. Next up, Mike Clancy.
Okay, well, good afternoon. So Prospect represents what people might describe as the technical civil service. Our members are from a STEM background. They are in central departments in the civil service, but largely concentrated in arm's length bodies and in delivery roles, whether it be in DEFRA, the Ministry of Defence, the UK Hydrographic Office, and so on. The interesting thing about our membership is the vast majority of them have a private sector comparator, and they could go and work in the private sector, and therefore don't conform to some of the stereotypes of public servants. Prospect is also predominantly a private sector trade union. Large civil service membership, as I said, but the fact that we deal with private sector employers allows us to talk to government, actually, from a basis of understanding and knowledge of how the private sector are doing it, rather than sometimes how the private sector is characterised by certain shades of government at different times. And something I've regularly said to government ministers is we have better relationships with private sector CEOs and their senior teams than we do with central government. And that's not necessarily down to the individual attitudes of ministers. It's down to the fact that we're dealing in the civil service in particular with an entirely broken system, a system that is actually now beyond repair, a system that has declined in terms of quality of engagement, personal rapport, reciprocation and trust, since the days that we dealt with you, Simon. And difficult issues are the order of the day for trade unions, regardless of the complexion of the government. We have a responsibility to negotiate and deal with the government of the day, as is put there by the electorate. This has declined considerably, and it crashed into, obviously, the cost of living crisis in 2022, 2023, and really illustrated the problems. It's a bit of a revolving door relationship with government ministers. I don't know how many times I've walked across from Waterloo, where our office previously was, to meet a paymaster general or a cabinet office minister with Dave Penman from the FDA, and it's the latest one. And you have to deal with it respectfully because they are there as the appointed minister. But I remember saying to Jeremy Quinn, paymaster general, about 18 months ago, someone who was a good, honest broker, had a good relationship with, and someone of I felt of you should respect the esteem of, what are you going to do if you win again? What's your process? How are you going to manage your civil servants? What's going to be the pay process? And there isn't one. There isn't a theory, a process, a thinking going on about central government, main department, and arm's length body pay. Recently had an engagement with John Glenn, actually quite constructive, wrote some on the subject. But all these ministers are prisoners of a pay remit process that is not fit for purpose, that is run by the Treasury and is actually about pay control. It's about cost control. It's not about engaging on the needs of central government and its missions, whoever is the government of the day. It's not about trying to deal with the unarguable issues of recruitment and retention across a range of jobs in the civil service. And don't listen to me on it. Read the NAO report of October, November last year. The pay remit process is laden with glacial timescales, even where arm's length bodies or others want to put in business cases for flexibility and one to another. It can take 18 months, 2 years to get them through, and that's not an exaggeration. It's very important to understand in the context of central government arm's length bodies, there's no progression through the pay scales. And this is what's also contributing to the attempts by different employers to get round it by promoting people. And then you've got the issue of grade inflation and those sorts of HR processes, which in the long term don't work because you're finding workarounds to a fundamentally broken system and can also drive issues in relation to equal pay, equal value and so on. So there's no progression within central government, and people therefore have to try and find constant workarounds. What does this lead to in terms of delivery? Well, I keep asking my colleagues to check this number I'm going to share with you, but MOD's got 15,000 vacancies. I find that absolutely extraordinary. But then I don't, because the sort of skills in there, private sector defence companies pay far more than the civil service ever will do. So don't be surprised if the MOD can't be an intelligent customer in the context of defence procurement, for example. Take the HSE. We represent many regulatory inspectors in different parts of government. You spend 2 to 3 years, 4 years as a warrant holding inspector, tremendous experience. Guess what? You can earn a lot more in the private sector as a health and safety manager. The only reason you stay in public service is because you've got a commitment to public service. It's not going to pay the mortgage. It's not going to pay the rent in a lot of cases either. So this is the problem that's built up now over a decade or more. We can trade numbers about real terms loss, but is anybody going to argue that civil service pay has declined 20-odd percent or so in real terms? And you can also say that for different parts of the public service. What's the response to this? Well, look, I don't want to spend too much time talking about minimum service levels because actually I say to the trade union movement, don't spend so much time talking about minimum service levels because actually it's a bad piece of legislation which is going to collapse under its own architectural incompetence. The first time, you know, it's been, you know, sort of put into the field, as it were, ASLEF have demonstrated the consequences, which is that there'll be more strikes. Oh, this is not a good idea then, is it? In places like nuclear decommissioning where we represent members. Incidentally, nuclear decommissioning has been brought into the pay remit process. What a nightmare that is for people who want to keep the right skilled workforce in nuclear decommissioning. They're not even going to bother with MSLs because they know that unions like Prospect and so on will never put safety at risk. If we have to prosecute a dispute, we're not going to leave nuclear installations unattended or in a state of any sort of question. That's just beyond the pale. So we've got a piece of legislation that's tilting at a windmill. And hopefully will be one thing that Labour should do if it wins, take it off the statute book, and let's return to the real issues, which are how do we create good employee relations? And good employee relations are not born out of trading battles on the statute book. Labour's got major challenges, and we may bring this out in questions. You know, expectations management, they're not going to have a magic wand, but the amount of challenges built up, and in particularly in terms of delivering their mission through their civil service, it's considerable. I'll finish on this point. Both in the public and the private sector, there is an absolute dearth of employee relations skills. Unions need to learn sometimes as well just how to negotiate. Negotiating is not just saying what we want and staying in that same space. Doesn't always win me friends anywhere when I say that, but negotiation is about understanding both sides' position, understanding where the compromises may be, based on reciprocation, based upon trust, and based upon long-term relationships. We've got that in a number of private sector areas, but in general, we've got to rediscover the ability to negotiate with each other, both publicly and privately. Key to that, and I'll say it because others can't, is that you have well-resourced convening spaces and you rebuild the institutions in this country where we can actually talk to each other. Well, the feuds that are left are ACAS and HSE, and both are under-resourced. So one of the things I particularly talk about is that if we're going to have better employee relations for the future, whether it's Labour's New Deal or if the Conservatives or others win again, how are we going to actually have the conversation, have good employee relations? It's built upon having the right skills, and they're in short supply in this economy.
Thank you. On to our third speaker, Raj Dutta.
Thank you very much. So I'm the Chief Executive of the Universities and Colleges Employers Association, which is not a public sector employers body. Universities are autonomous employers, and I represent about 150 of them in any normal annual pay round. But my experience prior to that is I work both for the British Medical Association and the Police Federation, and I can see some former colleagues in the room. And so I've got experience on both sides of the table negotiating what definitely is the public sector and something that isn't. And I'm hoping that some of those experiences may be useful for this discussion. And my reflections would be there are probably three things that are really important in any negotiating process, and they've been touched upon already. But for both sides, and it is, there are two sides in the negotiation, you have to demonstrate three things. Legitimacy in being at the table and what you represent, who you speak for, and both sides have to have confidence in that, that the right people are in the room and that they're talking to the right people. Secondly, trust, absolutely, it's been touched upon, that there are formal and informal stages of negotiation. There's what's in the public domain, what you can report and what you can't. But you can't get to what's really important in terms of reaching a resolution or even being at the gates where there might be a resolution possible if both sides don't have trust in that process and the individuals they're speaking to. And then the third part is just this point about managing expectations. And often that's something that's levelled at unions by employers. You've got to manage your members' expectations. But sometimes it's the way around. And I have as a representative of a multi-employer bargaining system, I have to do that with my members as well. And I suspect in government that's really important because there'll be agendas that you want to prosecute as an employer, which you can't fully deliver unless the workforce is engaged and the unions are part of that discussion. So it's a two-way process. If I reflect on some of the experience I've had, what's been really important, and I think that in terms of where we are at the moment, particularly in the electoral cycle, we're clearly thinking about what any future government will do in terms of industrial relations. And there's clearly two challenges. One is going to be the financial challenge. So we've been through a period of very high-level industrial action over the last 18 months, driven by cost of living pressures, completely understandably. But even though inflation's coming down, the future government's going to inherit this financial position in terms of public sector debt, and therefore that's going to play into some of the negotiations. At the same time, I'd like to think that any future government's got an agenda of its own for public sector reform. In either circumstance, negotiations are going to be really difficult because of the context of both the unions and what their members are after, but what the government's trying to do. And if I reflect on my previous experiences, both in policing and in health, whether it's been positional, transactional bargaining, or even principled bargaining, what's always been important is a shared understanding of what's possible. And I can remember, I'm thinking my colleague Dennis, I won't spare his blushes, we used to sit in meetings on behalf of the Police Federation with the Home Office and the LGA as a technical group, trying to work out what the payable looked like, what the actuals looked like for police numbers, what that might mean for any potential uplift, whether it's possible. And similarly, I was at the BMA trying to help the various committees negotiate changes to contract reform. There was absolute trust between the analysts on both sides about what the paper would look like, what the implications of different models of contract would look like. And if you don't have that trust and that faith in the process, then actually everything else is much, much more difficult. And to be clear, simply having a shared understanding doesn't make the negotiations necessarily a smooth path. But without that understanding, negotiations are immeasurably much more difficult to do. It's been touched upon as well that the need to have an understanding of where the other side is coming from, and understand the constituencies, and not simply the people you're negotiating with directly, but the decision-making processes on both sides. And you can underestimate that, really. You can go a long way with the person who's in the room with you, and you can build up that relationship of trust. But you also have an assessment about, even if you think you're close, can the other side really sell it outside of the room? And sometimes it's tempting to really try to get everything you want, and you might be almost there, But if ultimately, at the end of the day, that can't be achieved in the wide, you know, with the wider constituency that you're negotiating on behalf of, then actually it's a fool's errand in that negotiation to push the point too much. Processes are really important. Sometimes it seems that negotiations are a bit ritualistic, they're a bit process-driven and procedure-driven, but actually that process can often help reach a position which everybody understands, and the buy-in comes along from that. If something feels like it has been rushed or imposed, or there hasn't been due process, there isn't going to be much faith in that for those who are looking at this with a degree of scepticism or cynicism or just anxiety about what those changes might actually mean. And despite, no matter how much time and effort you invest in relations between employers and unions, there will be points which, no matter how far you've got, if the negotiations are really difficult and you've explored every avenue and you've got trusting relationships, you still haven't managed to get to a position that both sides really feel comfortable with. And that context, and that at that point, safe spaces are really important. And I mean, I've had to use ACAS in each of those previous roles. At the Police Federation, is baked into the process that before there's a review body, there's something called the Police Negotiating Board. And because police officers couldn't go on strike, when there was a deadlock in pay, it was ACAS who ran the tribunal process for reaching a resolution. When I was at the BMA, ACAS was responsible for some of the contract deals, some of the deals that emerged from a deadlock. And just last year, when we had a very, very difficult dispute in higher education, we had to go to ACAS to help us try to find resolution to that. In each of those circumstances, what emerges isn't necessarily that far apart from where you were to begin with. And sometimes it just seems like common sense packaged up. But having somebody else do that for you and allowing a solution to emerge from that context rather than either side owning it to begin with can often take you much further forward. So I too would laud the role that ACAS plays. But what I'd say as well is that all those things coming together lead to one further thing, which is really important, which is, as well as representing and understanding your constituency, you have to show leadership on both sides and a willingness to take risks and a degree of creativity. And sometimes it's easier not to do that because of the mandate you've got. I said as much for employers as for unions, but that creativity really relies on those other things: legitimacy, trust, and managing expectations. So those would be my thoughts, but I'd be interested in the discussion afterwards.
Thank you. And now to our final speaker, Kate Nowitzki.
Oh, thanks so much. And I really didn't pay my colleagues to say those positive things about ACAS, but I'm grateful nevertheless. I took on the role as Director of Dispute Resolution at ACAS about 2.5 years ago. I think if I could have seen the future, maybe I would have thought twice. Who knows? Some important valid points in there. I'm going to just pull in a few of my own to add to the mix. I'll try and keep it brief. I'm conscious of the time, and I'll edit as I go. Probably just worth very brief reflection. 18 months ago, when things were at their absolute zenith of disruption, I was describing it as a perfect storm in the public sector, that perfect storm being the acuteness of the cost of living crisis, the undisputable, as Mike's laid out so clearly, deficit over many years in public sector pay, and the sense of almost a moral sense of wanting COVID payback. Isn't it interesting? It's 4 years ago this week that all hit the proverbial. So I think it's worth just bearing that context in mind. When I was reflecting on today and the points that I wanted to pull out, I was sort of thinking about, I like thinking threes, three things and a letter of the alphabet, three S's. Well, I've digressed from that hugely, but let's try it. Surprise. Baroness Finn talked about surprise in negotiations. I think there was an element in which parties were taken by surprise by the extent of the depth and range of feeling and the extent of the industrial action, which we're still seeing some of that today. And I think there's a reflection for us all to consider: how do we see the storm coming? Are there some things we can learn from that? So that's a point. My second S is skills, laid out already here. Could not say it more better than Mike, and won't attempt to. Hope we can unpackage that a little bit more in this conversation. It's a very big deal, that skills issue. Skills very specifically around negotiation and within the wider framing of our understanding of industrial relations or employment relations. How do we even talk about it? Sustainable relationships. Notice I got that S in there, the third one. Then it all goes wrong. I think there was something that you said, Mike, actually, about the sustainable relationships, the short-termism versus the long-termism. And if things are focused only on the short-term, getting the job done, getting it out the door without attention to that longer-term relationship, were in difficulty. And of course, then a fourth S came in, which is structures, which others have talked about, and pay review bodies and so on and so forth. There's definitely some issues in there. And it is, isn't it interesting, that contradiction between some of the short-termism but the glacial progress that Mike talked about around some of the structures. And then some other singular elements and reflections from myself. In talking about industrial relations and pay, I think Baroness Finn referenced it as well, it feels to me as though the national discourse around this has become quite narrow. Maybe I've just been in ACAS too long, but it seems to me it used to be more nuanced, more reflective of those wider issues, greater thoughtfulness as some of the issues that you've talked about there, Raj, too. So that more binary feel around industrial relations doesn't feel helpful to me. And definitely recognising the legitimacy of the position of other parties. Raj talked about it, Mike's alluded to that too, and Baroness Finn in talking about trust. Where you can see and feel that there's a genuine, authentic respect for the position of the other party, you're definitely in a stronger place to get to a solution, however difficult that might be. Where there's an inauthenticity, a deeper disregard underneath, then you're in trouble. And I think it's right for me to say that also links into the authentic voice of representation of the people in the room too, whether management or trade union. Are the parties in the room really speaking for their constituents, or are they being pulled by external forces? Political, if you will, with either a small P or a big P, whichever, but when that happens, and that certainly has been the case in these recent disputes, then that makes things very, very difficult. So any or all of those are really great points perhaps for us to unpack.
Thank you. I'm now going to ask a few questions before coming to the audience. Do keep submitting them online. Simone, I wanted to come to you first. If you were still advising the government, or indeed were advising an incoming government, what are the key initial things that you would be telling them to do differently to try and resolve some of the problems that we have?
Well, certainly tone matters. There has to be a clear position of what the government wants to achieve, and equally certain is that the union leaders will come with a shopping list of demands that they want fulfilled, and somewhere you've got to find some common ground on both sides. But my main advice would be build the relationships again, come to the table, and show that you are willing to listen, that this is what you need to be able to set out. But as long as there is a constructive dialogue and that they're trying to achieve things in good faith as well. And understand that for a minister that, you know, a trade union is there to represent employees, to represent members. They need to show that they've actually won something for their members too. And to sort of the arrogance of saying no the whole time is not a constructive way forward. So listen to what it is. And, you know, and we didn't, when we were doing the pension negotiations, we didn't know what the concessions were necessarily going to be. But they came up because, OK, so you're worried about the lower paid being affected. We'll carve out the lower paid. You know, the people under a certain amount won't need to be affected. You're worried about those closer to retirement. We'll deal with that. But these were all achieved through sort of really quite constructive dialogue rather and leaders trying to achieve the best for their members too. And that, it does come down to, at the end of the day, the relationships.
Mike, I was going to ask a similar question. We were talking before in the green room about the kind of the difficult situation that on current polls an incoming Labour government is going to face. You've already talked about kind of scrapping the Minimum Service Levels Act as one thing that could be done quite quickly. What are the other things that incoming government could do to kind of reset the relationship and start to fix the system you said was fundamentally broken?
Okay, well, look, I think the Minimum Services Level is a good example of where you don't want to be in employed relations overall. You see, I will perhaps, you know, caught a bit of controversy. I think the responsibility of trade unions is to achieve negotiated outcomes and actually to maintain industrial peace. I often say that trade unionism is a mix of charm and menace. You should emphasise the charm on most occasions, but you've got to be capable of biting and being menacing if necessary, and having that independence from the employer if they behave in a way which is damaging to the interests of members. Now, industrial peace, though, comes from trust, reciprocation, process, having the institutions and the convening spaces. Labour's got a new deal for working people. I've been talking to a number of people. We're not an affiliate. And in fact, therefore, we probably get on better with the Labour Party in many respects than some of the affiliates do. But my issue would be, how are you going to make the new deal for working people operate in practice? How are you going to make sure that private sector employers are comfortable with these changes? There has to be a significant rebalancing of the employment relationship. Too many employers have had untrammeled authority for too long in this economy, and it's driven, in our view, a low-wage, low-skill economy rather than a high-wage, high-skill economy. But employers will want to talk about productivity, they'll want to talk about efficiency, and they'll want to talk about global competitiveness. The public sector will undergo major change. Technology is all around us. There's a new generation of technological change happening day by day. There's concerns about it, but it can also be liberating. This requires, what am I saying, the private sector, capital and labour to talk to each other. It requires the state to think about what its size is going to be, how it's going to engage its workforce. I think there's going to be more permeable boundaries in the future between the public and private sector. And how do you enable that? How do you enable that? Because you've got pension complications, HR complications, pay complications. This all requires spaces in which we can talk properly to each other on the basis of credible evidence and work these things through. What Labour will have to do is really manage expectations and set a pathway to recovery. Because when it comes right down to it, it's a bit like designing the most perfect energy system where our members work. Unless you've got something in power to go down the lines, doesn't matter how beautiful the architecture is. Same on this. Ultimately, you're going to have to find some more pay and more resources in the public sector, because there is now a consequence of real terms pay losses, which can't be ignored.
Raj, I'd like to come to you next. The UCU's most recent ballot to renew the mandate for strike action didn't meet the turnout threshold. The same happened for nurses last year. What are the implications of an unsuccessful resolution for both sides in industrial relations? Is it the equivalent of a score draw, or does it store up problems for the future?
I think that if a union has prosecuted several disputes and repeatedly done ballots, so at some point there's going to be ballot fatigue setting in. And it's tempting in those circumstances for employers to think, actually, you know what, the dispute's over, the employers have won. But essentially, if you haven't addressed the underlying issues as far as you can and demonstrated you've tried to do it, you are probably storing up systems and problems for the future. But there'll be times, though, when there's just limited capacity for employers to try to address those issues. And it comes back to this point about trust in the relationship and a common understanding of what's possible. Because you can carry on a dispute with both sides saying, you know, we want more of this or less of that all the way through without any understanding about how you're going to resolve the dispute. And if ultimately you can't come close to trying to have a shared understanding, then in the short term, it probably is a weakness for unions that they haven't managed to get over that ballot threshold, and members may start to question their support for the union. But it doesn't actually translate into more support for the employer proposition. So everybody's got a shared goal here in trying to make sure these disputes don't take place in the future, or you've done your best to try to resolve them. There will be some times, though, and I'm about to start our pay round next week, and it's going to be a difficult pay round. I'm almost certain of that because of the financial constraints facing the higher education sector. We will try our best to try to find a resolution. Last year was a very, very difficult dispute for higher education. And you see other unions and other sectors where they've been through several ballots, and after a while, members will stop kind of lending their support for that. They'll want to move on. People can't be emotionally angry about something all the time. So it's a risk for everybody, both employers and unions, to try to make sure you find the ways to try to resolve this as best as you can.
Kate, come to you next. Both you and Mike talked about the decline in employment relation skills in HR, and obviously ACAS has a kind of brilliant, unique insight into that. Without naming names, can you talk about some of the problems that you've seen in that space?
It's definitely a real thing, that decline in skills, and it's been exposed by the recent disputes, and it's been exposed both in the private sector as well as the public sector, but singularly so, I think, through the what we've seen in the public sector. So I was speaking with a trade unionist just before Christmas, and he'd been speaking to an employer who had said to him, "We don't have employment relations here." Well, that's an interesting reflection, isn't it? If in the wider economy, employers, public or private or whoever, if there isn't an understanding of employment relations, there is never going to be the investment in the skills and knowledge needed to sustain good employment relationships. And as we've already heard, relationships are a key part. So it's a slightly multifaceted thing. I think the point I really singularly want to make there is that the skills themselves sit within a wider framing of how we talk about employment relations, how we talk about industrial relations. We're not even sure what the language is there. You're right, I'll be careful what I say about what's happened in the public sector, but I will call out what I think, although it's interesting, it was really helpful actually to hear your comments, Mike, about your own experience. I would actually call out and say, in terms of the better practice over the past 18 months, that seeing the skills which I know are vested in the trade unions in the civil service, in Prospect and FDA and PCS, and in the relationships and knowledge that exists in the counterparts in the Cabinet Office, I think that is a good example of where knowledge and skills have been deployed to good effect. I'm sure it's Mike's story to tell as to how tricky that ride was through the way there, but in comparison with some of the others. And I will reflect on the fact that within ACAS, we do have singular skills and knowledge. There are pockets across the public sector where there are singular skills and knowledge. And I think there is a lesson to be learned about drawing on that skill and knowledge and making use of it. Maybe I shan't dive too further into that, but I think there's something about using the skills and knowledge that do exist and then building those up and having that wider discourse around it.
Thank you. I'm going to come to the audience for questions. I'm going to take a few questions at a time. If I come to you, can you please wait for the mic to arrive in front of you? Can you say your name and organisation? And can you please ensure that it is, in fact, a question and not a very long statement? OK, who in the audience would like to... OK, we'll come here and then these two in front as well.
Hi, I'm Mary Bousted. I was Joint General Secretary of the National Education Union, and last year we achieved the biggest aggregated ballot of teachers, over 300,000 in an aggregated ballot, and took 8 days of industrial action in pursuit of a pay claim. So I've got very recent experience of the issue of a protracted pay dispute. I would just say two things. One is that when public sector workers take strike action, it is about pay, but it's also about other things. We wouldn't have achieved the ballot thresholds, and it's the biggest ballot threshold to be achieved under the new levels, unless there wasn't also significant concern about a whole range of other issues, including workload, including status, including a sense that the profession just hadn't been listened to. So I think the first thing is that it was about pay, that you can legally put your dispute on pay, but there are other things as well. And secondly, I would agree that there was a complete lack of understanding of unions. Just a lack of understanding, a complete belief that we wouldn't make the thresholds, and when we did make the threshold, a complete inability to negotiate and to know who you were negotiating with. It quickly became clear to us that we were trying to negotiate with the Treasury, who were in the room but utterly silent. So my question is, given that we've had 12 years of both a coalition government and then a Conservative government who have gradually gone feral in an understanding, in their shared internal understanding that unions have no power, how can an incoming Labour government, through the New Deal, start to work with the civil service and start with work with the Treasury to try and recreate the position where unions exist, they can exercise power, and they have to be dealt with professionally? Because I saw none of those things in the dispute that we had last year.
Thank you. And then I think... Here and here.
Hi, Tevye Markson from Civil Service World. This question's for Mike. What are your priorities in this year's civil service pay talks? What does the government need to do to avoid more strikes this year? And you said the system is beyond repair. What would you replace it with?
Thank you.
sorry, I'd just like to endorse Raj's point about trust. That is very important between the parties in these situations, although the Police Federation has slight uniqueness in it at that time. But the main thing, I think trust has to be obviously on both sides. And it seems to me the unions have to actually start looking at the way they calculate their loss of pay. RPI is gone. It's finished years ago. It doesn't exist statistically. It's not a very good measure. If you went to CPI, the doctors would only have been not 35%, they'd be asking 25%. It would actually bring the sides together a bit more. And the other thing is they should take more account of, which unions don't like, I know, in the public sector, is basically pensions. Pensions are part of total pay. That's had a pay review body look at it as well.
I can bring it to a question, please.
Well, yeah, I mean, in other words, don't you think you should maybe changing your view sometime, moving towards employers by going to CPI? That actually exists in Europe. All negotiations revolve around CPI, not RPI. And a pension should be included. It is part of deferred pay, basically. And it doesn't occur in the private sector.
Thank you. So should we move to CPI and take greater consideration of pensions into account? How could an incoming Labour government rebuild understanding of unions within government? And then a question specifically for Mike about what his priorities will be in upcoming negotiations.
Cover all three as rapidly as possible? Okay. So CPI is often used nowadays. Secondly, you can't pay your mortgage through your pension, which is a defined benefit pension scheme, which won't pay out until the end of your service. But also, very happy to have a whole compensation conversation, because you'll still find the private sector is ahead of the public sector, particularly when you take into account bonus and progression. I've got no problem about having a whole compensation conversation about public servants and private sector, because I can see the private sector ahead amongst the people I represent. Secondly, priorities for this year. Well, it's looking like it's going to be a return to some form of austerity, I think, given the commentary that's come from the Paymaster General already, I think, in the context of the teachers' pay process, and also what's gone in there from the Department of Education. Our priority would be get as many people out of the civil service pay remit as possible, actually, quite honestly. You know, the fact that we've got, it's had mission creep, including the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, the fact that arm's length bodies are often trading funds which generate their own economic circumstances, they shouldn't be actually probably covered by the pay remit process. And therefore, if we can get, we've written to the Paymaster General on that basis, published it to our members, that actually this is really holding things back. Look, I think this is going to be probably another very difficult year, where it is possible that a number of our branches will want to consider some form of action, because they're going to be facing a very limited pay remit. What would we do differently? Might seem strange, but I think we do have to explore a properly constituted pay review body with maybe some of the processes that actually underpin the social partnership in healthcare. Now, lots of pay review bodies have had a bad press, because the government's able to decide to discard the analysis and discard some of the recommendations. But ultimately, within a completely redesigned industrial relations system, I'm staying this side of saying national bargaining, because I don't think it's going to happen practically, and I don't think Labour's going to want it, right? But what Labour can't do is carry on with the current delegated system mess that it currently has. It's got to do something different. So it's got to be around some sort of pay coordinating body, probably for the delegated grades. Really look at the arm's length bodies who've got these private sector competitors and trying to fish in labour markets that public sector pay just doesn't do it. It's going to have to be around that. And we'd really want to try and engage with labour if it's going to come into power around those matters. Coming back to Mary's point, look, I've said it already. What trade unions exist to do, I think, is not just to issue demands and stand on the demands. Because I'm an employer of staff, and if my staff union issues a demand to me, it probably doesn't go down so well. But if they put a well-researched case and they're prepared to bargain, That's what you should do in a reciprocal relation based on trust. That's it, that simply. We've got to find those trade-offs, those processes Raj just talked about it, the credibility, and build an architecture that makes that happen. Over three decades or more, we've allowed every single institution that's a convening space, apart from ACAS and HSE, to atrophy or disappear. It's not surprising, therefore, that we shout at each other through megaphones, because we haven't got spaces in which we should sit and work these things out. I really think Labour should be promoting, through ACAS again, the right to collective bargaining as part of the New Deal process. And I think they need to think very carefully about those skills which will make the New Deal work on the ground, employer by employer in the private sector. For me, the most important thing in the next 10 years is that the private sector trade union membership moves from 12% to something higher. That's actually very important to the public sector, because otherwise public sector trade unionism will look like an oddity. Let's solve it in the private sector first, learn those lessons and build back into the public sector.
Thank you. Tom.
I was just to take the point about the RPI, CPI and the total reward. We did try and look at it at some stage, and there was a lot of resistance because that there is a case for the whole package being in the public sector, a sort of, it should be looked at in its totality. I totally take your point, Mike, that a defined benefit scheme can't be spent on the mortgage, but equally in the private sector, you have to save for your pension, and that's money that you have to put to one side as well. So it swings around, right? And it is a benefit of the scheme. Having said that, when you made the point about the way that the only way that people in the civil service can get any sort of extra pay is by moving on and being promoted, it means that the skills that they pick up in one particular role are jettisoned because they're in pursuit of going for another promotion elsewhere, doing something else that they haven't been trained up for, leaving a gap that is actually quite important in the public sector because of this. So I think that that's actually a valid criticism, something that needs to be properly looked at. What was the other? Mary's point. I couldn't agree more. I mean, if you are listening, then there are a whole range of issues other than pay, which is what I was saying. You know, you argue about one thing, but actually then you realise that it's actually the terms and conditions, that actually there are other soft concessions that you can win and that matter. But that's, again, the point that you've got to have the dialogue the whole time and properly listen. And as for negotiating with the Treasury, I mean, their view of negotiation is not... I spent a lot of time in 2011 arguing the definition of negotiation with the Treasury because and they didn't understand. And when I said it was about tone, it's also about the wording, that if you table things as proposals rather than plans, it means that there is room for discussion. If you say these are our plans, everyone immediately hears this is set in stone and there's no point, you're not going to be doing this in good faith. And as I say, we were lucky that Danny Alexander was engaged at the time. But the other ridiculous thing in the civil service especially is that the Treasury manages the pay and the terms and conditions of staff are managed through the Cabinet Office, and there has to be a better way of actually bringing that together.
Raj.
Thanks. I think I'll respond to two points, actually. And just to say, declaration of interest, that was Dennis who asked the last question, who I worked with the Police Federation. I acted for 14 years before today, I don't think, but I didn't plan to ask that question, but I couldn't agree more about the point about RPI and CPI. Our preferred measure of inflation in my organisation is CPIH. But I think the more important you make is actually about the whole approach to reward. It's not a matter of public services per se, but the teachers' pension scheme, which universities are already also affected by, is going to see a 5 percentage point employer contribution rise in April, which is unfunded. It's 24% at the moment, it'll be 29%, straight out of the pay bill. And yes, you can't cash in as a mortgage, but also universities have no funding to support this. So whether or not people can use it to pay their bills, employers have to find that, and that has to be taken into account in terms of discussions around the pay bill. So there has to be some recognition of that in any discussion. And I think that is something that we just need to get used to talking about much more. But there's also other... pay is often a very not the most, it's, pay is often not the prime motivator for people going to work. It's the psychological contract, which I think speaks to Mary's point, that often a lot of other things have broken down by the time you get to a major dispute. And it doesn't take place at the top, you know, just based on the culture at the top of the organisation. Every level of an organisation where there's a management relationship has a part to play in that. So the employer's overall approach to how they reward and motivate their workforce is really important. And the other point I'll just make is actually about what a future government might need to do in terms of relations with the unions. Before I worked for the Police Federation, I worked for the TEC for about 10 years, and it was under the last Labour government. And there were lots of conversations. Part of it was based, let's say, on architecture, infrastructure. So alongside the Public Services Forum, there's a Public Services Liaison Group within the TUC. I'm sure Mary sat on it at one point. Lots of ways in which unions and government could speak together. And that wasn't important just in terms of policy outcomes. It was important in terms of increasing the understanding of processes and personalities. And in any negotiation, once you get outside of the formal negotiation, outside of the formal negotiating room, the set-piece discussions, you'll reach a point where you can't go any further formally. And if you let the conversation stop there, you will end up in a dispute. You need people to have the understanding of the personalities can help to make the weather outside those formal settings. And if you have no understanding of how either side operates, the pressures are under individuals, that people need to get elected into post. Unions are not amorphous kind of monolithic bodies. There are different constituencies within them. There are small p politics at play. Those things are as important as the actual nature of the claim. I suspect, on the other side, within government departments, there are different pressures as well that need to be put into play. You talk about the Treasury versus other departmental agendas. Without that understanding and without that ability to make the weather in those conversations between the formal processes, things will break down. So I think a priority for any future government is how do you give people the exposure to those relationships and those conversations to gain the skills themselves and the experiences and the personal relationships that you can build on it so you can pick up the phone at a key point when negotiations look like they've stalled. Because what I'm hearing is this partial outsiders, I think some of those relationships may well have kind of gone by the wayside in the last few years. And if that's the case, there's a lot of rebuilding to do for any future government that wants to invest time in ensuring a good relationship to avoid industrial disputes in the future.
Okay.
Thanks. I think you'll understand that I, as a director in an arm's length body funded by government, I choose my words carefully in this forum. But I think, nevertheless, irrespective of which government comes next, whoever that is, I think the starting point is to have a conversation a bit like this, with where there are experts in the room, in the audience on the dais here, to get that considered understanding and reflection. That's got to be a good place to start, so we can start to breathe some life back into understanding how we do build. I liked your phrase, Mike, reciprocal relationships built on trust. That's a theme across all the speakers today. And how we can then make best use of those appropriate spaces, whether they're convening spaces, whether ACAS or elsewhere, and getting that conversation started as soon as possible has got to be a priority to get us that agenda, that item right back on the agenda and at the forefront and see the real benefit.
I'm going to take a question from online, and Kate, I might put this to you first. How does the panel feel disputes today are influenced by the fact that so much appears to be negotiated in public, in terms of on social media, media interviews today, compared with, say, the 1970s?
It's a real challenge for us, actually, in ACAS, a real practical challenge, where you know, we've conciliated in disputes where parties have been then going doing live tweeting, and it's really thrown things off. So the answer to the question, I think the question was, to what extent was it? Mm. I mean, yeah, it can be to a significant extent. It's certainly changed our practice in how we lay the ground rules down quite firmly. And I think the sort of wider, just that wider social media discourse can be very unhelpful. Some parties might say that it can also be very helpful, I'm sure. But we prefer to keep things tight if we can.
This point about negotiating in public, I did appreciate how difficult it was when we were doing the pensions negotiations, because, of course, there were a lot of private conversations behind the closed doors. It's terribly difficult. It was very important that those stayed very private because they were quite detailed, etc. But and therefore it had to be coordinated as to what story you were telling the public. So we'd have to negotiate that when there was a big union meeting, I think Mary used to come to them, you know, that Brendan Barber, as the head of the TUC, would go out and he'd make the public statement, and that everyone was still sort of at loggerheads and quite a way apart, whereas in fact things were moving in the right direction. But the minute you said that, everyone was sort of, well, what exactly are you doing? So it is a hindrance that you're actually doing quite detailed, complex negotiations in the full glare of publicity.
Mike?
Look, I think social media is a nightmare at the best of times, and is a complete nightmare when it comes to conducting industrial relations. You know, the tone and the content, that everything is intrigue, everything's betrayal, everything is made suspect, makes the entire process of having conversations, constructed or otherwise, with an employer of any form, really difficult. You know, I've been around this for quite a long time, and, you know, some of the normal instruments and means of getting to a place of sensible outcome where you exchange drafts, or you're talking about, if you say that to us, we can respond in this way, and you're exploring those options. A lot of commentariat want to describe that as betrayal. They want to describe it as failing to stay unincorporated or independent. Nothing could be further from the truth. These are the skills of persuasion. These are the skills that bring about compromise and negotiation in the context of a long-term relationship. And I always say to employers, you know, you get the unions you work for, right? If you don't inform your representatives, you don't develop them, and you then put them in positions where they feel uncomfortable with the nature of the data they're receiving or whatever, don't be surprised if you get a negative reaction. Also, how have you developed your managers to communicate with the workforce and so on? Wrap social media around that, and it does really become nightmarish. These are the things we've got to find a way of re-establishing, right? No problem with falling out with employers. No problem with having a row. You just can't do it every day, yeah. Right? You can't do it every day. You've got to know when you're going to do it, and it's best to win if you're a union, okay? Best to win. So these things are, you know, we need to go back to school on this.
Jazz?
I think I endorse the view that negotiating in the public glare is not helpful. But also the flip side of it is now it's just the nature of society we live in. There's this thirst for constant knowledge. And it applies as much to industrial relations as everything else. People are waiting to see what the outcome of that negotiation is. They want constant kind of bits and morsels dropped in. And also, I think to Mike's point, everybody's got an opinion. You know, I've never, you know, when I've worked on the other side of the table, you never get thanked for a deal that you'd negotiate as a trade union official, because somebody's always could have done it better than you can. And it kind of X or social Facebook, it just amplifies all of that. So it is difficult, but I think we also have to recognise that people want to know. And if you're in a process where you're able to share communications and messages with each side beforehand, that's great. But when it's actually a very difficult dispute, of course you're not going to let the other side know exactly what your strategy is going to be, especially for unions trying to force employers. So for employers, that's an element of sitting on your hands. And it's often very tempting to see all of the comments on, I'm going to say Twitter, X, and thinking, you know, should we be correcting this? Should we be correcting that? Should we be putting our own perspective? But you have to realise as well, that in all of that, you probably aren't even really helping the overall goal that you're trying to get to. And sitting on your hands as an employer can be quite frustrating, but probably the right thing to do. And sometimes you have to let these things play out and hope, again, to Mike's point, that the union itself has a strategy for dealing with this. Because it isn't usually the union account that causes problems. There's actually lots of armchair activists who've got views about things, but not fully informed. And they can't be, because they're not part of the negotiations. And there are things that you are saying in confidence to try to get to yes. And so it can be quite frustrating for as an employer's body, but also the right thing to do is just to turn the other cheek and hope that behind the scenes or through branches, through reps, the real message is getting through. But it is a challenge for employers as much as it is for unions, I think.
I just wanted to make that one point, because there's a massive prize in getting a negotiated settlement. That's why it's very important for the government to listen properly and to actually realise that there have to be some real concessions and with some real understanding. Because the ultimate prize is that if the government is busy telling the employers, the teachers or the civil servants, that this was the best outcome that could be achieved, they are about 10 times less likely to believe than the heads of the union saying, look, we've done our best and this is what we think is the best that can be achieved. So it is a massive prize, but it has to be taken seriously.
Thank you. And on that note, I'm going to bring the event to a close. Thank you very much to our four excellent panellists for what's been a really thoughtful discussion, to ACAS for kindly supporting the event, and to all those who've watched in person or watched back later. Thank you very much.